Hey there, Insomniacs. Welcome to a new episode of Up at Night. My co-host and friend over there is Chris Noel.
And I'm here with my friend, Sarah Adams. And these are the stories that keep us up at night.
Hi, Joshua Adams.
Hi, Sarah Adams.
The part of Chris will once again be played this week by Joshua Adams. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks for having me back. Glad to do part two. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun last time, so I'm glad you're back to help me close out this case. But first, we do have a little bit of doc talk this week.
I even contributed.
He did. I made him watch something. So we checked out the new documentary on Netflix called What Jennifer Did. And that was a wild one. My dear sweet husband, who does not normally watch a lot of true crime, was so hopeful that what Jennifer did was something heroic.
It was not.
So I don't think that's even too much of a spoiler alert. It's kind of in the title, What Jennifer Did. Really good, though. It was definitely, I don't know, it threw me for a loop, even though I kind of knew what was going to happen. It was still a lot crazier than I expected. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I felt like halfway through I knew what was going to happen, and then three quarters of the way through I was like, okay, I definitely know what's going to happen, and then by the end I was like, wow, that is actually what happened. That is crazy.
Yeah, so, definitely. It gets you. It does. It gets you. But it was a really good one, and it's not on HBO Max. It's on Netflix, so take that. And then I actually have some semi-interesting local news to share. So a 16-year-old missing persons cold case got a new break this week in Springfield, Illinois, when a woman renovating her house found a purse buried in her crawl space, along with some identifying documents, which I have to assume is like a driver's license or something. She contacted the police, who came out to search the crawl space, where they also found the buried remains of a woman missing since 2008, Michelle Bianco. Bianco was last seen in 2008 on April 5th, so I mean almost exactly 16 years, on April 5th, getting into a black Pontiac with a person who had addressed her by name, not far from where her remains were discovered. An investigation is ongoing, and the autopsy results are currently pending. That's like right in our backyard, really. Yeah, I mean, it's not far from us.
I was actually thinking about that earlier today, and like the people that were waiting on closure and just the number of people in the town, like that's a pretty busy street. And thinking about like the last 16 years, how many times I and other people have like driven past and gone on every single day. You don't think about what is under people's floorboards or in the basement. I mean, even this person was remodeling. Like, they weren't even the resident there in 08.
Yeah, to be fair, this person bought this house in 2017. So, I mean, they're almost certainly cleared of any wrongdoing. But kudos to them for doing the right thing, for, you know, calling the cops and being like, you know, hey, there was, there's this purse in my house. Because, they did end up finding a body as well. So, it's unnerving. I don't know that I can quite describe what I feel about it, but hopefully the case can get resolved and bring some justice to the family, and we'll keep you posted on this one and update you as we know more, as it's, literally, again, right in our backyard. So, you want to get back to the staircase, Josh?
Indeed.
Are you ready?
I am.
So, we last left off on a bit of a doozy. I was telling you that the prosecution now believes that Michael Peterson has killed before, in the exact same way. The woman they believe he killed first is Elizabeth Ratliff. So Elizabeth Ratliff, mother of Michael's adopted daughters, Martha and Margaret, was found dead at the bottom of a staircase in 1985, 16 years before the death of Kathleen Peterson. And like, here's the thing. Before we can go any further, I'll just say this. I have a story that I think is kind of relevant. My father died in my childhood home from a heart attack in 1989. In 2002, 13 years later, my mother also died of a heart attack in that very same home, about 15 feet from where my father died. And I did not kill my parents. And I know, look, a heart attack is obviously way more common than being found dead at the bottom of a staircase. I'm not implying they're the same, because they're not. But correlation does not equal causation. But for the prosecution, it does. So, we know from multiple people that Elizabeth Ratliff had been having severe headaches in the weeks leading up to her death. Her original autopsy done in Germany states that her cause of death was an aneurysm that caused a brain hemorrhage. A spinal tap was even done at the scene to confirm this. But the state is so set on proving that this is related that they call for the exhumation of Elizabeth Ratliff for more testing, despite the fact that the Germany doctors all concluded that she had died from an aneurysm and then fell down the stairs. But the DA, Jim Harden, who I absolutely loathe, agrees, and the exhumation process proceeds. And all that would be fine, but my true beef with this whole thing is the fact that the new autopsy is being conducted by the same medical examiner that declared Kathleen's death to be a homicide. I don't know, I feel like they should have to go to a neutral third party on that.
Because, for sure. I mean, you can, yeah, like, this person already has some, like, thought about the case.
Stake in it, yeah.
They could be able to potentially say, like, oh, yeah, I think this because, you know, and I don't know.
I mean, I feel like she's going to be looking for Ratliff's death to be a homicide at that point. And again, the doctors in Germany confirmed an aneurysm. I cannot stress that enough. But they bring her body from Texas all the way to Deborah Radish in North Carolina anyway. And shocker, guess what Radish concludes? It's a homicide now, too. Injuries resulted from a violent attack. Now, she has lacerations on her head, and shockingly, I'm going to give you this one, she also has 7 lacerations. So it's insane that they have the exact same number of lacerations on their scalp, but the lacerations don't look the same. They do look different. These are a little more curved than the ones on Kathleen.
Which is, so this is crazy to me too, that a person would even think like, yes, this person's MO is getting close to women and then throwing them down the stairs or something like that. Like, who uses a staircase as a reliable murder weapon right, in any situation?
And he only strikes once every 16 years.
Right. It doesn't even seem like it would make any sense at all to assume that the two could possibly be connected or have anything, any relevance.
Yeah, it doesn't really comport with, you know, what I think is normal logic either. But, you know, it's not me. But, you know, another reminder, this is the biological mother of Martha and Margaret. No matter what, these two poor girls have just been through hell. The mother they've known, Kathleen, is dead. Their father is accused of her murder. Their biological mom is now being exhumed after almost 17 years. And now their father is accused of causing that death. And for what it's worth, they still stand by Michael 100%. They never sway. Those girls are always at his side. And frankly, there's no motive for Michael to kill Elizabeth. There was nothing to be gained financially, and in fact, he ended up raising her 2 children, which, and I love my kid, but he's kind of a financial burden, if anything. So, you know, it's crazy. But so the trial begins, right? July 1st, 2003. It's been over a year and a half since Kathleen died at this point. And you'll kind of come to find that that's pretty common, but especially in this case. Everything gets dragged out as far as possible, including the 13-episode documentary. But the prosecution comes out swinging. They have a replica of what they believe to be the murder weapon, the infamous blowpoke. They wave it around and show it to the jury. They put an officer on the stand to tell the jury how bloody the scene was and remind everybody that it was dry. They show us the shorts that Michael was wearing that night. There's blood on the front and the back, as well as a spot inside. They show video footage of the crime scene. And again, it's unbelievably gory. But we know David Rudolph is no pushover. He comes in hot, too. They have several police photographs of the same scene with differences in them. When cross-examining the officer on the stand, the officer tells David Rudolph that he was told these were glitches that happened during photo processing. But he can't say who told him that or how many photos may or may not have these glitches. So it calls into question the credibility of, at minimum, the photo evidence in this case. I mean, it's literally 2 photos on the same day at the same time and place, and one seems to have a blood drop on it, and then it's gone in the other photo. So people, I mean, the prosecution isn't helping themselves, basically. They look bad, too. The guy on the stand has no idea how to explain why these photos look different, and it's pretty compelling. So then the prosecution brings in their star expert witness, blood spatter analyst Dwayne Deaver. And I hate him so very much. He is so slimy. But his testimony is huge. It carries a lot of weight with the jury. He has this whole replica of the staircase in the courtroom. He's explaining all the different spatter marks and how many blows to the head this would take. He tells the jury that the spatter he sees is consistent with what he has seen at other crime scenes that involved a beating. And he talks a lot about the small spot of blood on the inside of Michael's shorts. There's also a bloody footprint on Kathleen's leg. And this looks bad. It's on the back of her leg. But of course, Michael contends that this all happened during his frantic attempt to save her life while calling 911. And again, remember, it's a super bloody scene. So I can imagine you'd get some amount of blood on you.
Well, yeah, but like, so I'm trying to envision this in my head. If there's blood on the front and the back of the shorts and a little spot on the inside. I mean, if we're talking like one spot, maybe I can explain that away. But like, I've been in oily or dirty situations or whatever.
Sure.
And like gotten my pants dirty. But even if I get the front dirty or the back, it's not covered. Like, if I get
not.
Muddy. Yeah. Okay, so...
Yeah, they're
so
not, like, covered.
Is
but
it,
there's,
like, handprints of blood?
It's not handprints, like, but it's just, like, some, you know, streaks of blood in one spot, and then there's some, you know, kind of...
So maybe that could happen just from, like, normal
like would,
movement.
Yes.
He's picking her up and move, or trying to
right,
do something
yes,
or interacting with the body.
Picking her up,
okay.
Putting, you know, the paper towels under her head, okay. And, you know, her part of her body presses up against his shorts.
Sure, okay. That
but
makes
it's that
a little
drop
more sense.
On the inside that Dwayne Deaver is, like, really pushing.
How
he
far
says,
up the inside?
Remember, a couple inches maybe? But he's saying it could only get there through spatter from a beating.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't have the experience in it, but I would think that, like, when I wear shorts, sometimes they're baggy and they're loose, and if I bend or sit a certain way or
right.
If it's something, like, really, really filthy, like, I could see getting something
yeah.
inside that seems odd. Like, how did this happen?
Sure.
I mean, I've had situations like that in my personal life with, like, food getting
yeah,
on me
and
somewhere.
Yeah, it's hard to say without, like being there at the scene and seeing it go down to be like, you know, exactly how this... I'm sure he can't say exactly
sure.
how it got there. But so we cut to the scene with the defense, and then we're watching video footage of Dwayne Deaver conducting these experiments that lead to his expert testimony. And this footage is crazy. I've never seen anything like it. You see them doing all kinds of crazy things to get the blood spatter the way they want to see it. You know, so it matches the crime scene photos. He's working backwards. The defense even meets with a DNA expert who agrees that Deaver was working backwards to get the result he wanted. I mean, he's, like, beating a sponge, and he's, like, changing his angle, and he's doing these, like, short slaps on it with the blow poke, which is no way that you would ever attack somebody. You would definitely pull back from far. And the problem with that is there's no cast-off on the ceiling, and that's
right.
sort of what the defense has always said.
Well, and small little spats with this thing, I mean, you know, and the sponge itself, like, we're not using the same materials,
right.
It's all kinds of different stuff. Yeah, if I could sit here all day and figure out exactly how to make a certain spatter
right.
on the wall, like, that's
yeah.
called
he's
art.
Looking,
it's not evidence.
Right, yeah. It's, that's, there's a big difference there. It's like that would be a great... You know, you could start up an Etsy shop, Dwayne, and have, you know, art by crime scene. But it's not science. I mean, science just doesn't... At least not how I understand science. So Rudolph, naturally, just tears into Deaver on cross. He does a really good job of bringing his credibility into question. He even gets Deaver to admit that he had done what's called a Lumalite test on Michael Peterson's shirt and that he saw no blood spatter. So this is fucking news to David, and you can see how giddy he is, because withholding potentially exculpatory evidence is a big, fat Brady violation. It should have ended there. Somehow it doesn't. So, I mean, I think that's big, to have the shirt that Michael was wearing that night, and there's no spatter seen. Now it's like a dark blue shirt, so people were saying, like, oh, it wasn't visible to the naked eye, but, like... It's
yeah,
not,
you
know,
see it.
We're not still talking Jack the Ripper. Yeah,
yeah,
we have things like, you know, luminol to be able to tell us these things now, and there was no blood spatter. So I think that's relevant.
And in something like that, I mean, it wouldn't be a small amount of blood on his shirt anyway. If somebody beats somebody to death in a violent way,
yeah.
I've got to think there's going to be more than just microscopic bits of blood all over it.
From the scene that, you know, they've described and that we see in the photos,
yeah.
and from the beating that they
face,
describe,
hands, shirt, pants,
he should
all
be
over.
Covered in it,
yeah.
yes. So it's a ping pong match back and forth between both sides. Rudolph tells us that he's looked back at the last decade worth of beating deaths in North Carolina, some 257 cases, and cannot find one instance where the skull was not fractured and the brain was not damaged when a beating involved blows to the head.
Do we have any of those that have also found the killer and we've been able to look at their clothing? after that situation to see what they looked like as well. That would be kind of interesting to see.
That would be a really good addition to the evidence in this case. So next, the prosecution puts Kathleen's sister Candace, my favorite, back on the stand to talk about this fucking blow poke. Take a drink. But honestly, for me, it's a big mistake. I don't know why they put her up there. They read her statement to police 1 month after Kathleen died, and she is on the record saying that Kathleen and Michael's relationship was loving and healthy. But on the stand, she says under oath that she's changed her mind when she learned the more private aspects of Michael's personality. And, like, guys, she's talking about his sexuality. Yes, the affairs, but his hidden bisexuality absolutely has her clutching at her pearls and implying that it somehow means he was capable of murder. So to sum up, she'd never seen him or known him to be violent. She'd never seen nor known them to be unhappy as a couple, but since he likes men, he must have killed her. So says Candace. And I've just never been convinced that Kathleen ever found out about the affairs. It doesn't make them okay. I mean, I make it sound like I'm all Team Michael when really I can't stand the guy. Unless it was their arrangement, like he says, we'll never know. But they're definitely just putting more weight on these affairs because they were with men. And I keep saying affairs, and I'm about to sound like Michael here for a second, but I think that's the wrong word. He occasionally paid men for sex. The biggest problem is that Michael and defense have put forth that this was a perfect marriage. And to put it simply, the prosecution is saying, obviously not. Now, again, but
perfect is not a word that needs to have, like, one definition.
Right.
Perfect for them.
Right.
You know, perfect couples have people that are perfect for them. There's not right. a perfect individual or a perfect situation. It's what works for those people that exactly. are involved. And to say that, well, apparently it's not a perfect situation because of X, Y, Z, you don't know. Maybe it would have been a very imperfect situation had this scenario not been playing out the
right.
way that it had
yeah.
been.
Had their life not become a public spectacle. Mm. Yeah, it's hard to dissect without knowing what Kathleen knew and what she thought about it. But so let's meet one of the men that Michael had been communicating with. He comes to trial. He's fun. Meet Brent Wolgamott, a.k.a. male escort Brad. He takes the stand and tells us that he was in communication with Michael via email in August 2001. This is months before Kathleen's death. He says they had plans to hook up with Michael for sex in September of 2001, but Brad himself actually canceled these plans because he had to catch a flight and he was too tired. But he also tells them, and I think this plays well for the defense, that a majority of his clients are married men. There's actually this super funny moment where he's being asked about the types of men that he had for clients, like what their careers are. And he says some doctors, lawyers, one judge. The courtroom erupts in laughter as the judge says, not this judge, with a grin. We get him throughout the documentary. He's actually pretty good. But everyone has a laugh, and Brad goes on to tell us that most of his clients are actually even bisexual married men. And I think this just sort of tells us that, yeah, again, what you just said, my perfect isn't necessarily your perfect and vice versa. What they had might have worked for them. Who knows? But again, this doesn't land with me the way I think they wanted it to, but I'm not on the jury, and I think it does land with the jury. So they also spend a lot of time going into great detail on Elizabeth Ratliff's death. Yeah, what did you think about that? You didn't really react to that. I mean, now that you know the information, how do you feel about this other body at the bottom of the staircase?
I mean, I think it's just a coincidence. Yeah. I think that, I mean, given a situation, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, anything can happen, and... You know, this is just one of those situations. I mean, I bet if we looked at a cross-section of, like, everybody ever that has ever existed, there's more than Michael Peterson that have had multiple people that they have known dead at the bottom of a staircase. Or dead under similar and kind of mysterious
right.
or odd circumstances.
Probably more in that category.
I mean, for all we know, there could have actually been another instance of this, though, in how many people have ever existed and lived in the
right.
world and
yeah.
things like that. Like,
yeah.
this isn't really that far-fetched when you think about it. You know,
I mean, it's wild, but yeah, it's
inherently
not...
inherently risky. A person falls down, and people fall down the stairs all the time.
Yeah.
And if this aneurysm thing that they were talking right. about happened at the top of the stairs, and she goes, thump, 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 yeah, like, yeah, that's yeah. gonna be
that's,
enough
yeah.
to damage somebody. So, you know, I don't think that it means anything other than he just happens to be the most unlucky person around stairs.
Right, yeah. I mean, it looks bad, obviously. I get that it looks bad. I cannot really deny that. Yeah. But it's not an impossibility in any real way.
Right.
But they bring forward multiple witnesses who also describe that that scene was very bloody. But those same witnesses also report that Elizabeth had been having these headaches that they were talking about in the days leading up to her death. Elizabeth's sister goes on the news with awful Nancy Grace, and now she believes her sister was murdered as well as Kathleen. Mm. So, you know, now we've got both victims' sisters, you know, throwing their hat in the ring to be heard with all that. But with that, the state rests their case. Wisely, David Rudolph decides not to put Michael on the stand to testify.
Good choice.
After we saw the ridiculous things he was doing,
yep, that was a good move.
As the practice run. Yeah, I don't really judge that, honestly, in most cases, nor do I judge it here. It's a gamble for anyone to take the stand. It's staying cool under the duress of cross is tough. I have, like, generalized anxiety disorder. You know that. I wouldn't be able to handle it. So I don't really ever judge that. The defense does, however, put up their own expert who says that the blood spatter is not consistent with a beating because of the lack of cast off on the ceiling as well as the lack of blood on Michael's shirt from that night. Y'all... On day fucking 50 of this trial, the jury takes a field trip to the actual staircase. It has never been cleaned.
Jesus.
He is still living in this house, in this with the staircase, with the scene, the blood spatter on the wall is still present. It is ghastly.
If you...
Go okay. Stay in a hotel!
So, just so, again, we talked about this in the first episode, the house is huge. So, luckily, this man does not have to go up these stairs every day.
Yeah, there's probably enough house to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah, and if he needs another way upstairs, it's possible. So, he doesn't have to see it. But still, that would be a very weird thing to have to share a house with. And would prevent closure of any kind.
I would think so, too. I would have a really... I personally, like, I mean, I joke, but, like, I just wouldn't be able to live there. I wouldn't be able to handle that. That would be too hard for me.
Because, yeah, the thought is, we'll just ignore it. But then, you know, you're sad and you miss your wife, and that's literally the last thing that you have left of her at this point.
God,
it's like,
yeah.
You know, that's the spot that you would go probably more often
than... Yeah, it starts to get really macabre,
you
right?
You think about it, yeah.
Yeah. But so, before the defense can rest its case... Another bomb gets dropped. Take a drink every time you hear it. We've found the blowpoke.
Fantastic.
It's been in the garage of the Peterson home this whole time.
Covered in blood?
Nope. Leaning up against a wall. Covered in cobwebs.
Great.
Yes. The police searched this home. The Petersons searched this home. Yet there it is. And it's unequivocally not the murder weapon. It's dirty. It's not bent. Or disposed of somewhere, it's not been cleaned, and upon testing, there are no traces of blood. So, like, game over, right?
Yep.
Sleep well, everyone. You would think that was it. But no, the prosecution has Candace bring in more replicas of these blowpokes she's given out as gifts. This woman and her blowpoke. And again, shocker, they're all a match. So this is for sure the missing blowpoke, guys. But they still argue that it doesn't mean anything, and it cannot be confirmed as the blowpoke, and maybe it was another weapon, but it's like, you guys have tied your whole case to this fucking blowpoke. So, with that, the defense rests their case, and closing statements are made. Freda Black gets up for the prosecution and shouts words like bisexual, purity, filth, and anal sex to shock the jurors into remembering that that's apparently a motive for murder, even though there's no evidence to prove that Kathleen even ever found out. The defense reminds the jury that everyone, including Kathleen's sister and daughter, said that Michael and Kathleen had a strong, loving relationship. But more importantly, the defense also reminds the jury about the meaning and the gravity of beyond a reasonable doubt, and that this burden lies on the prosecution. Jury is out for 5 days. Josh, what do you think the verdict is?
Well, I would say not guilty if I were sitting on the jury of this case. Based on everything that I'd learned, finding the murder weapon to be completely clean, and all of the other blood evidence, not guilty.
See, and that's where I'd come in too. Michael is found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without parole. And I mean, it's a mess. The daughters, Margaret and Martha, are sobbing, the family is a wreck, Sometimes I wonder if I'm watching the same thing as everyone else. Because I remember the first time I watched this, I was just stunned. I was, like, flipping tables. Like, how did this just happen? How did we get here? This case is so full of reasonable doubt. I just thought there's no way. I didn't know back then what I think happened to Kathleen, but I certainly didn't think Michael had killed her. I didn't think it then, and I still don't think it now, which I assume is kind of where you land. You don't really feel like he killed her, or at least that there certainly was enough reasonable doubt not to convict.
Correct.
So I think it was kind of a mixture of things that swayed them. I think the death in Germany really swayed people. The affairs, of course, which again, I concede, looks really bad. But mostly, I think a lot of the weight was in Duane Deaver's testimony about the blood. So that's the end, right? That's where we come to a close. Except I'm only on episode 8 of a 13-episode series. So clearly not. Fast forward to 2011. Michael has been in prison for 8 years.
And it has aged him.
It has aged him greatly. I mean, I don't know, like, he looked old at the start of this thing, but
he looked like a youthful old.
A youthful old,
like,
right.
Somebody that you can tell they're probably in the, like, 50s or 60s of their life, but they look like they're in shape and they're well-maintained.
He looks like the president does after an 8-year term.
Yes. Yeah, if nobody knows what she's talking about, seriously, go look up any president before their 8 years, if they've run an 8-year, before their 8 years and after their eight years, and see the physical changes that kind of stress puts on a person and what stress can do to a body.
It's stunning. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But so he's been there for 8 years. Every appeal they have filed has failed. But now, all this time later, there's been a development. Remember the prosecution's star expert blood spatter analyst, Duane Deaver, the slime ball I hated on sight? Well, it comes out publicly that Deaver has been falsifying his blood reports for years.
All right, Michael, time to go home.
Right? Open the doors! This news breaks after the exoneration of a man named Gregory Taylor, who had been convicted of murder in 1993, based primarily on testimony from Deaver that he now admits was false. So David Rudolph is back, and he wants a new trial. There's a hearing to decide. It comes out that Deaver has falsified reports in at least 34 cases. Jeez. I mean, that's what they found, right? Like, that means there's more. Several experts come in to testify about a few of these other cases, one after the other. They all completely refute Deaver's findings in these cases, as well as in Michael's case. And they win, guys. Michael's granted a new trial. He's granted bond and goes home with a fancy ankle bracelet. He's now 68 years old and destitute. The property he was so proud of is long gone. He now stays with a family friend on what looks like a condominium neighborhood.
Yeah.
The trial and the appeals have more than bankrupted. He's absolutely just completely destitute. But he's out. And then nothing happens for 2.5 years. In 2014, he petitions to be let off house arrest and have the bracelet removed. It's now been on him an unprecedented amount of time, and the courts grant that. Kathleen's sister contested, of course, calling him a flight risk.
Yep.
And look, if I really believed he killed my sister, I might say that too, but it's absolutely preposterous. I mean, this man is like 71 now. Come on. I mean, he's not running.
He hasn't been running this whole time. He's never attempted to evade. He's never attempted to, I mean, other than saying that he's not guilty for the crime, he's never shown any indication that he would try to leave or that he even wants to let it be thought that he is a murderer. He wants to do anything he can to stay
to clear
in this case
name.
And
to
be involved.
Yeah. No, it's preposterous. It's absolutely ludicrous. And then, you know, we start to get into the last few episodes of this series, and they really could have been, like, one long episode, but they really drag it out. There's all these pointless photo montages of Michael, like, looking sad off
and
into
the
distance.
Not Michael from The Office looking sad when they do that
no,
with him.
No, not good Michael. Well, I mean, I don't know. But it's a lot of Michael talking, and this guy really does love the sound of his own voice. I mean, please understand me, listeners, I cannot stand him. I just don't think he's guilty. And, like, I'm a writer, too. I'm a little quirky. I get it. But his love of his own stories definitely borders on narcissism, which is a super overused term nowadays, but I think it kind of fits here. So at this point, it's been so many years. Everybody has come so far. The question becomes, do we even go back to trial at this point, or do we work on some kind of plea deal? The state is not going to drop the case, which is what Michael's hoping for, but it's not going to happen. They want a plea, or they will go back to trial. And as we've said, Michael's now 71. He's financially destitute. Indigent, I think, is the legal term. He's got grandkids now that he wants to spend time with. But Michael's one thing is he will not admit guilt. He is steadfast in his story. He didn't kill Kathleen. He loved her. And he won't take any kind of plea deal where he has to say he's guilty. So a guilty plea with time served is out. But there's also the Alford plea. And this case is where I first learned of the Alford plea, but I've seen it in other cases now. And I want to make sure I get this right, or I'll be hearing from our listener Mark, who is an actual living, breathing attorney. But an Alford plea is a guilty plea where you don't have to admit your guilt. You can still maintain your innocence while pleading guilty in this way. It's kind of like saying the state might be able to convict me based on what they have, even though I didn't do it. But on the record, you're still a convicted felon. But, of course, here we go with Candace. Kathleen's sisters and her daughter won't hear of it. And the brand new DA won't go against their wishes. So it has to go back to trial. And David Rudolph bails at this point. He tells Michael he cannot take this thing to trial again. And he sends him to Mike Klinkesum, the lawyer who got Greg Taylor exonerated. And another two freaking years pass. I mean, this really... it just gets dragged out so long. And I feel bad for both sides of the family, because even if you, you know, Kathleen's family who believes he did this, it sucks for both sides to have this drawn out for so long. But it's 2016. Kathleen died almost 15 years ago at this point. Michael is 73. But new lawyer Mike has been hard at work. He wanted to review the evidence for possible retesting and found it was all contaminated. Bags ripped open, nothing sealed. There's even a piece of evidence in there from another fucking case. And again, this is like the fourth or fifth case I've covered so far in this podcast where there's evidence tampering or mishandling of evidence or lost evidence. Get it together, guys. So, you know, they even found a I already did that part.
It's a disaster.
Yep. Cut that out, Chris. It's a disaster. He also discovers Kathleen's own clothing had never been tested. So, I mean, God forbid, had there been a third person or an intruder, which I don't really think, but if there had been and their DNA was on her, we would never know. We can't know whether Michael's DNA was on her clothes, which could be considered exculpatory if his DNA isn't there. And then new lawyer Mike has a fucking stroke right before the latest motion to dismiss the case.
Are you being hyperbolic?
I am not. He literally has a stroke.
Well, that's not great.
This is insane. It's chaos surrounding this case. It's just nuts. So new lawyer Mike's partner takes over, and now we have new lawyer Mary Jude Darrow. She files the motion to dismiss the case based on all this contaminated evidence. It's denied. More months pass. Now we're in 2017, and the DA is finally ready to deal. David Rudolph is back, and the Alford plea is back on the table. But they had to do this whole pissing contest for a bunch of years where they go back and forth before we could finally get to this point. Michael is offered the Alford plea to a charge of voluntary manslaughter with time served, allowing him to be a free man on February 24th, 2017. Free, but a convicted felon.
So, I want to say something about this Alford plea and Michael's unwillingness to, like, say that he is guilty in any way, shape, or form. So, if, from my point of view, like, if I'm a person that did this and somebody's like, yeah, you're considered guilty, but with time served, like, you're never going to hear about this again. Like, that's the end. You never have to think about it. You're a felon. And like, some part of me thought, like, well, I basically kind of got away with it, you know,
right.
Sort of a deal like that. Like, why wouldn't you do that? But he is so committed to proving that he didn't do this.
Yeah.
And I feel like if the outcome is the same either way, but dragging it out or taking an Alford or even being willing to go back to trial over this thing is something that, like, drives him and motivates him, that – speaks to me as just an onlooker as a sign of innocence.
Yeah.
Why would you want to continue digging into this case?
Right.
If, you know, there's a possibility that you could be found very guilty. Right. Not like guilty with time served. Like,
yeah.
You definitely murdered this woman. You're going back to prison for 20 years because of something that we found. Like,
exactly.
If you get the out, take the out if you're guilty. But he didn't want to do that.
Yeah, and he fought to the very end of not even wanting to do the Alfred plea.
I know all the things that I've mentioned in the case for me that make me feel like maybe he didn't do it are just, you know, speculation. Oh, a person did this or a person does that, and it's just mannerisms, and it doesn't amount to much as far as evidence goes. But I do really think that the way a person chooses to play out something or act in a situation determines or can show a lot about their guilt or innocence.
Yeah, I think it definitely carries weight when people hold true to their innocence for over the course of a long time. Like, you know, I mean, I sometimes come down hard on Adnan, but that's one of the things in the, like, positive column for him is he has held to that story this entire time that he is innocent. And the same thing with Michael. When you are committed to that story, it does hold some weight for me. It does make me believe that you're more likely telling the truth.
And not to say that everybody that maintains their innocence all the time is this person, but, like, he's actively spending money. He's driven himself entirely bankrupt to go through this entire process, to do everything that he can to get justice for Kathleen, to get, you know, the innocent name for himself.
Right, clear his name.
And just anything that he can do. And he just, I feel like a person that, you know, maintains their innocence but is actually guilty, they go to prison and they're just like, I didn't do it, man. I swear I didn't do it. And they don't do anything about it. They're not, like, constantly trying to get a new trial and do this and try that and hiring lawyers and everything else.
I don't think you drive yourself into the ground like he did over, you know, if you really did do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we even get an interview actually with the judge. I don't remember I know you watched that part with me, if you remember that. You know, and he's been there the whole case, Judge Orlando Hudson. And he says now that, you know, looking back, he's not sure whether certain evidence should have been allowed. He says he thinks that a reasonable juror today would likely find reasonable doubt, and that he has reasonable doubt. So that's where the legal case ends. For the prosecution, and for Michael and his family, for David Rudolph, for the filmmakers, it's over. But you guys, what the fuck happened to Kathleen? So, there's a number of theories. Let's go through them and discuss. I think most people fall into one of two camps, but we're going to cover three. So first, many people still hold true to the belief that Michael was guilty, that he did kill Kathleen. Diane Fanning even published an award-winning book in 2005 about the case and how she thinks Michael is guilty.
I mean, and if we're looking at it from all technicality, Michael is guilty.
Right. On the record, Michael he is guilty.
Yes.
And so let's talk about some of the things that actually really do look bad for Michael, not the things that they shouldn't have brought to court. The bloody footprint on the back of Kathleen's leg.
Can't picture how that would get
there. Yep, that's a tough one for me. The blood drop inside his pants, I don't know, I kind of go back and forth on that one. And then there's smear marks in the stairway that look like somebody tried to clean the blood. But I don't know that wasn't her.
Like trying to reach to the wall and smear it down or something.
Exactly, yeah, trying to like lift herself up. We also know that Michael is known to have lied about other big things. He's not a reliable narrator. And he was definitely unfaithful to some degree in his marriage to Kathleen.
Well, and we say unfaithful, meaning that there was something going on outside of the two of them.
Correct.
But again, if that's something that they had said yes is okay, then, you know, it's fine.
We can't confirm whether or not she was okay with that. So just sort of a little tidbit that kind of looks bad, and it's good to know about him. Michael dated one of the editors of the documentary The Staircase for 13 years. Her name's Sophie Brunet. She even has a character in the, that's probably Brunet, she's French. She even has a character in the fictionalized HBO adaptation of The Staircase. The doc was definitely working to make you think he's innocent. There's no doubt about that.
Sure.
Also in 2008, Caitlin Atwater, which is Kathleen's daughter, filed a wrongful death civil suit against Michael for her mother's death and won upwards of $25 million.
Wow.
So any and all money that Michael would ever make goes to her. So enough jurors in a civil suit found him liable, which I think you just need a majority in a civil suit. You don't have to have a unanimous. But, you know, this narrative where Michael is guilty, it requires a motive. People always go back to saying that, you know, Kathleen used his computer and discovered the gay porn. God forbid. But the computer forensic report actually says that his computer had not been accessed since 4 p.m. the day Kathleen died, which basically eliminates any chance that she discovered a secret, at least in that way. And if she doesn't find that, as far as I'm concerned, all motive for Michael is gone. The death of Elizabeth Ratliff is so clearly unconnected to me. Is it weird? Yes. Fine. I give you that it's weird. But it is not impossible to know two people to die from completely different things, just both on a staircase. Because again, neither of them died from the fall on the stairs. One had an aneurysm, the other I'm going to explain here in a minute. But it's just that they both randomly happened to die on the stairs. And yeah, it's a little weird. It's a super unfortunate bad look for Michael. But the only professional who has ever concluded that Elizabeth Ratliff died from anything other than an aneurysm and fall is Deborah Radish, who can't be trusted because she's compromised by the prosecution. And where are the injuries on Michael? Where and what is the damn murder weapon? We know it wasn't the blow poke. So I've always had a really hard time trying to find any way where I can believe that Michael did this. So the second theory is a fall. How much time do we even spend on this? Does anyone actually believe she fell with no prior injuries? Look, upon finding her, I would have made that exact same panicked assumption. But once I started thinking clearly, I would be very confused about why there were lacerations on her skull at all, let alone 7 of them. A fall just shouldn't be that bloody. A fall doesn't look like this. Unless you were injured before the fall. Enter the owl theory. If you know of this case, you know this theory is out there. But it's not discussed in the doc. This theory was first proposed by a man named Larry Pollard, a lawyer and neighbor of the Petersons, after the filming had already completed. So the theory goes like this. Barred owls are known to attack people without provocation for absolutely no reason. Look up owl attacks on YouTube, folks. This is a very real thing. And it's what happened to Kathleen Peterson. 1,000% this is what happened. And I can hear you all naysaying me as you listen, but please, I beg you, hear me out. It's not as crazy as it sounds. Barred owls are known to live in the area where the Petersons lived. Walking up to the house from the pool that night, Kathleen was attacked on her head by an owl. It swooped down, digging its talons into her scalp, causing these tri-pronged lacerations we see on her head. She instinctively grabs at her scalp, trying to get the owl off of her, but also grabbing some of her own hair and its talon feathers into her hands. The owl pecks at her nose and face during the scuffle. The pool is so far from the house, Michael can't hear her scream. The pool has this water fountain feature. It's loud. So wounded, inebriated, and dazed, Kathleen goes into the house and attempts to go upstairs to check and clean her wounds. But she's too dizzy, and she falls down the stairs. She almost certainly even got back up at least once and fell again, accounting for the blood on the bottom of her foot. Then she lays there, bleeding out. It's probably hours before Michael comes in and finds her. That's why the blood is dry. She's probably on her last literal few breaths as he's calling 911. And what else is he supposed to think based on what he finds? It looks like a fall down the stairs. Because she did fall down the stairs. And she's at the bottom of the stairs, covered in blood. She was just badly injured way before the stairs, but there was no way for him to know that in that moment. If you look closely at the police reports, there's small amounts of blood found outside the home and on the door leading inside, which further adds to this theory. It's why there's no weapon. It's why there's no signs of an intruder. No spatter on the ceiling. Clumps of her own hair as well as microscopic feathers were found in her hands. And honestly, if the feathers don't convince you, I can't help you. The blood under her fingernails is her own. It's not Michael's skin or blood. Michael has no injuries. This is what happened. This is definitely what happened. I'm more certain of this than almost anything else in the world. So a lot of people ask, why only microscopic feathers? Why are there not feathers everywhere? That's because this attack happened outside. And tiny microscopic feathers are actually consistent with the types of feathers that owls have in between their talons. Think of, like, the fur in between a cat's toe beans. So, like, you know, here's the thing. Do I like Michael? No. He's a liar. He's a cheater. He's weird. Not likable at all. He sucks. He's also done some good things. His kids truly seem to adore him, and he them. He adopted those girls that weren't even his and raised them. And you and I talked about this. I think we both believe he loved Kathleen. I don't buy that she knew he was bisexual. I don't think she knew about the affairs. But I also don't think she ever found out. But more to the point, being a bad guy or an annoying guy doesn't make you a murderer. Being a liar doesn't even make you a murderer. Being a cheater doesn't make you a murderer. But you have to ask yourself, if you didn't know about the affairs or the death in Germany, would you still think Michael was guilty? Beyond a reasonable doubt? Again, little reminder, that's the burden of a prosecution. To prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And for me, this case has always been full of doubt. Not to play the same old tune, but two things can be true. Michael can be shitty and not be a murderer. And the owl theory can seem crazy at first and still be true.
And actually, I remember when I first rewatched this last week or 2 weeks ago when we were recording the first episode, when they show, and I'm still kind of shocked that they show as much gruesome stuff as they do, but the wounds on her head, and they're talking about like the trident style or like tri-prong or whatever that would have been used for it. My first thought was, if it didn't puncture the skull, but it has like 3 points to it, I thought of like a gardening claw
that a person would have. Yeah.
And like something like that would make sense if like you got onto somebody and like stuck it into their head and like pulled back.
Right.
You could like make that claw-like mark in the scalp without actually going through the skull and maybe causing some damage like that. And now hearing the owl theory, like thinking of their talons, it would almost be, I mean, especially with a good-sized owl, about the same width as that. So, like, that kind of weapon, whether it's a trowel or a gardening claw or an owl's claw, was what I was picturing as possible to have, you know, caused these wounds.
Yeah.
And if they never found anything like a gardening claw that actually did this crime, then an owl thing doesn't sound that far outside of the realm of reality to me.
Yeah.
I mean, in the area, owls are bigger than I thought they were.
Oh my gosh, and they're vicious. And
when I saw the one in real life for the first time, I was like, holy cow, that's way bigger than I thought. And I know they come in varying shapes and sizes, but I mean, if there are aggressive owls that will attack for no reason, or if it mistakes the head for prey, maybe it thinks it's one thing or another,
And do a lot of people die from owl attacks every year? No.
But some people have to.
Well, people get attacked by owls every year. I think the unfortunate thing that happened for her after is the fall down the stairs.
Yeah.
I think it's a combination of the both that caused her death. It's blood loss for me that ultimately caused her death.
Well, and as you were telling me about this, I was thinking and kind of answered my question. So if anybody out there is listening and had the same question, like, why isn't there more blood outside if this wound was caused outside? Like, hair is long and it's thick and it kind of absorbs like a sponge. So maybe the wound happened, it's a cut, it's bleeding, it's filling her hair, and like drips at a time are coming off. It's not just gushing everywhere, but all of that dripping, there's so much in your hair that you don't realize how much you've lost.
Right.
Then you start to get up the stairs, like you said, you're a little bit woozy. Maybe you do fall down and hit your head. And so, the stairs could also have contributed to either more of the wound. You know, if you have an existing wound and you hit it, it tears and causes more damage.
Yeah, it probably split the wounds more, made them bleed faster and more.
And then if she's sitting there, the blood's getting everywhere, she tries to get up again, you know, that explains some of that stuff. So I could see that happening for real,
Yeah, I mean, and it's horrible. It's horribly tragic. I'm sure, you know, it was slow and terrifying. But it's not as crazy as it sounds.
Yeah.
We even had somebody comment on our Facebook post for our first episode saying something about, can you believe that crazy people still think an owl did it? And I just kind of had to laugh.
We're those crazy people.
We're those crazy people. We think the owl did it. But I know of a lot of other podcasters who've covered the case too. I know some who don't think that the owl did it, but I know of a lot who I actually, you know, value and respect their opinions who also concur. You know, I think if you can really allow yourself to take a look at the evidence and take this notion out of your mind that it's insane, I don't know, maybe go YouTube an owl attack, then you can see that it's, you know, it's very likely. And I do think that's what happened to her. So. What do you think, Josh? Is the podcasting life for you?
Sure.
We've had some fun, right?
Yeah, it's been a good time.
Definitely. Well, thanks for joining me. That wraps up the staircase, guys. Thanks so much. Sleep well.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Up at Night. We'd love to hear what you think, and we want to know what keeps you up at night. Send us an email at upatnightwithchrisandsarah@gmail.com and give us your thoughts, corrections, and episode suggestions.
You can also follow us on all the socials, and please tune in again in 2 weeks for the new episode. Sleep well, everyone.